Nothing useful. The room began to fill as other agents joined them. All ties were loosened, all sleeves rolled up, all collars unbuttoned. As a group, they gave every indication of having worked through the weekend. Lacey called Darren and told him to join them. Trays of coffee, water, and pastries were brought in by secretaries. At 10, Vidovich called things to order and made sure the two video cameras were working. He said, "This is for informational purposes only. Since you're not a suspect, Jerry, we don't need to deal with Miranda." "I should hope not," she said, and got a laugh. "At the outset, I want to say that we would not be here if not for you. Your detective work over the past 20 years is nothing short of brilliant. It's a miracle, actually, and I've never encountered anything like it. So, on behalf of the families and all of law enforcement, I say thanks." She nodded, embarrassed, and glanced at Lacey. "He hasn't been caught yet," Jerry said. "We'll get him.
Soon, I hope."
"I'd like to start at the beginning. A lot of this will be repetitious, but please indulge us." She began with the death of her father and its aftermath, the lack of clues, the months that dragged by with little contact with the police and absolutely nothing in the way of progress, and what could possibly have been the motive. She spent years trying to answer that question. Who in Brian Burke's world had ever said anything negative about him? No relatives, colleagues, maybe a student or two. He had no business deals, no partners, no lovers, no jealous husbands along the way. She eventually settled on Ross Bannock, but knew from the beginning that she was only guessing. He was a long shot. She had no proof, nothing but her hyperactive imagination. She dug through his past, kept up with his career as a young lawyer in Pensacola, and slowly became obsessed. She knew where he lived, worked, grew up, went to church, and played golf on the weekends. She stumbled across an old story in the Ledger about the murder of Thad Leawood, a local who'd moved away under suspicious circumstances. She tied him to Bannock through Boy Scout records obtained from the national headquarters. When she eventually saw the crime scene photos, a big piece of the puzzle fell into place. She couldn't stop rubbing her wrists. She said, "According to my research, the next one was Ashley Barrasso in 1996. However, Bannock said last Saturday that he didn't kill her." Vidovich was shaking his head. He looked at Agent Murray, who was also in disagreement. Murray said, "He's lying. We have the file. Same rope, same knot, same method. Plus, he knew her in law school at Miami." "That's what I told him," Jerry said. "Why would he deny it?" Vidovich asked the table. "I have a theory," Jerry said, sipping coffee. Vidovich smiled and said, "I'm sure you do. Let's hear it." Ashley was 30 years old, his youngest victim, and she had two small kids, ages 3 and 18 months. They were in the house when she was murdered. Perhaps he saw them. Maybe for once in his life he felt remorse. Maybe it's the one murder he couldn't shake off. "Makes sense, I guess," Vidovich said. "If any of it makes sense." "It's all rational in his sick mind. He never admitted to any of the murders, but he did say I missed a couple." Murray shuffled some paperwork and said, "We may have found one that you missed. In 1995, a man named Preston Dill was murdered near Decatur, Alabama. The crime scene looks familiar. No witnesses, no forensics, same rope and knot. We're still digging, but it looks as though Dill once lived in the Pensacola area." Jerry shook her head and said, "I'm glad I missed one." Agent Neff said, That's at least 5 victims who had ties to the area, though none of them lived there when they were murdered. Vidovich said, with the exception of Leewood, they were just passing through. Lived there long enough to cross paths with our man. Neff said, and over a 23-year period, I wonder if anyone other than you, Jerry, would have ever connected the murders. She didn't respond, and no one else ventured a guess. The answer was obvious. 42. For his last meal, he dined alone. The kitchen opened at 7, and he arrived a few minutes later, ordered wheat toast and scrambled eggs, poured a glass of grapefruit juice, and took his tray outside to a patio where he sat under an umbrella and watched a magnificent sunrise over the distant mountains. The morning was quiet and still. The other patients, none of whom he had made an effort to meet, were waking to another glorious, sober morning, all clear-eyed and clean. He was at peace with his world, a serenity aided by a couple of pre-breakfast Valium tablets. He took his time and enjoyed the food. When he finished, he returned his tray and went to his room. On his door, a steward had tacked his schedule for the day. A group hike at 9, counseling at 10:30, lunch, and so on. He arranged his paperwork, then got down to business. He put on plastic gloves and wiped down all surfaces in the room and bathroom. He removed the small packets of pills from under the chest of drawers, returned to the bathroom, and closed the door. He stopped the sink and ran 3 inches of water, then dumped in 2 packets of hydrochloric acid tablets. Upon touching the water, they immediately reacted with pop and fizzle, and within seconds, the water seemed to be boiling. From 2 other packets, he shook out 40 tablets of oxycodone, 30 milligrams each, ate them, and washed them down with water in a paper cup. He flushed the packets, the paper cup, and the gloves down the toilet. He took a small hand towel, crammed it in his mouth to muffle any anguished reactions, then plunged all 8 fingers and both thumbs into the bubbling super acid. The pain was immediate and fierce. He groaned and grimaced, but kept pressing as the acid burned through the first layer of skin and began corroding the second. His hands felt as though they were on fire, and he began to feel weak. When his knees buckled, he grabbed the sink, unstopped it, and opened the door. He fell onto his bed, spat out the hand towel, and stuffed his hands under the sheets. The pain vanished as he lost consciousness. Diana was in the reception area when the FedEx envelope arrived at 10:35. She took one look at the sender's name and address and took it to her office, closing the door behind her. For the 3rd day in a row, their office suite was besieged by a team of brusque, even rude FBI technicians, and she needed the privacy. Her hands were shaking as she ripped off the tab and removed one of his office envelopes. Inside were 4 sheets of letter-sized paper. The first was a letter to her. It read, "Dear Diana, when you read this, I'll be dead. Sorry to do this to you, but there's no one else. Please call Dr. Joseph Kasabian at the Pecos Mountain Lodge near Santa Fe and inform him that you are my secretary, my executrix, and my sole heir. As directed in the attached last will and testament, you are directed to have my body cremated immediately and my ashes scattered over the Pecos Mountains here in New Mexico. Do not, under any circumstances, have my body returned to the state of Florida, and do not permit an autopsy. tomorrow, send the press release to Jane Camper at the Pensacola Ledger. Please delay notifying the police as long as possible. Ross. She gasped, muffled a shriek, and dropped the papers. She was crying when she picked them up. The second sheet was a press release, and it read, Circuit Court Judge Ross Bannock died this morning at a facility near Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he was undergoing treatment for colon cancer. He was 49. Judge Bannock proudly served the people of the 22nd Judicial District for the past 10 years. A native of Pensacola, he resided in the town of Cullman. A graduate of the University of Florida and the University of Miami Law School, he was in private practice in Pensacola for almost 15 years before being elected to the bench in 2004. A lifelong bachelor, he was predeceased by his parents, Dr. and Mrs. Herbert Bannock, and is survived by his sister, Ms. Catherine Lamott of Savannah, Georgia. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations to the American Cancer Society. There will be no memorial service. The third sheet of paper was titled Last Will and Testament of Ross L. Bannock. It read, I, Ross L. Bannock, being of sound and disposing mind and memory, do hereby make and declare this to be my last will and testament, expressly revoking all prior wills. This instrument is prepared solely by me and for all intents and purposes is to be considered my final holographic will. 1. I appoint my faithful friend, Diana Zhang, as my executrix and direct her to probate this will as soon as possible. I waive bond and accounting. 2. I instruct my executrix to immediately have my remains cremated and my ashes scattered over the Pecos Mountains outside of Santa Fe. 3. I give, devise, and bequeath all of my assets to Diana Zhang. 4. Other than the usual monthly bills, there are no liabilities. Attached here, too, is a list of assets. Signed, Ross L. Bannock. Stapled to the will was the fourth sheet. It listed 8 bank accounts with their approximate balances, his home in Cullman, valued at $700,000, a beach bungalow worth $550,000, 2 shopping centers owned by corporations, and a stock portfolio valued at $240,000. For a long time, she was too stunned to move or to think clearly. Any interest in his assets was negated by the horror of the moment. She managed to go online and found the website for the Pecos Mountain Lodge. An addiction facility? Nothing made sense. She called the number and was informed that Dr. Kasabian was not available. She would not take no for an answer and pressed on with the urgent matter. When he finally took her call, she explained who she was and so on. He confirmed the death, said it appeared to be an overdose, and could she call back later? No, she could not. He settled down and they had a conversation. One that ended with the arrival of the coroner. She found the business card for Special Agent Neff and called the FBI. The lodge was a pleasant getaway where damaged people began their new lives, not a place where people went to die. Dr. Kasabian had never dealt with the death of a patient, and he wasn't sure what to do. The last thing he wanted was for such a traumatic event to rattle the other patients. In his second conversation with Ms. Zhang, she mentioned the request for cremation and explained that she had clear directions from the deceased about what to do with his remains. Common sense, though, dictated the preservation of the corpse and the room until higher authorities were on the scene. When 2 FBI agents from the Santa Fe office arrived, he was not happy about their presence, but he was relieved that someone else would make the next few decisions. When they informed him that Judge Bannock was wanted on kidnapping charges, he quipped, "Well, I think you're too late." They stepped into the room and stared at Bannock. The first agent said, "We have technicians on the way and we need to fingerprint him." "That might be a problem." Dr. Kasabian slowly reached down, took a corner of a sheet, and pulled it back. Bannock's hands were swollen grotesquely. His fingers were black from corrosion, and his nails had melted and popped off. A rust-colored liquid stained his gown and the sheets under him. "Looks like he knew you were coming," Dr. Kasabian said. "Okay," said the second agent. "Don't touch anything." "Don't worry." 43. They were finishing lunch at a downtown cafe when an urgent call came from Clay Vidovich. They hurried to the FBI office in the federal building and waited in the conference room. Vidovich and agents Neff and Suarez entered in a rush, and it was obvious they had news. Without sitting, Vidovich announced, "Ross Bannock is dead. An apparent overdose at a rehab clinic near Santa Fe." Jerry collapsed and buried her face in her hands. Lacey was too stunned to say anything. Vidovich went on. He checked himself in early yesterday morning, and they found him dead in his room about 3 hours ago. "Our agents there have confirmed everything." Allie asked, "What about Prince?" "Not so sure. I just got a video from one of our agents there. Do you want to see it?" "Of what?" Lacey asked. "Our man in rehab. There's one part that's pretty graphic." Jerry wiped her eyes, bit a lip, said, "I want to see it." Agent Murray pressed some buttons on a tablet, and the video began on a big screen behind Vidovich. He moved out of the way as they gawked at the image taken with a smartphone. Bannock had not been moved and was lying face up, eyes closed, unshaven, mouth half open, a white liquid leaking from one corner, dead as a doornail. The camera moved slowly down his body and stopped at his hands, which had been placed next to each other over his crotch. Vidovich narrated, "Probably dipped his fingers in an acid right before he died." Allie mumbled just loud enough to be heard, "That son of a bitch." The camera zoomed in close on the fingers and Lacey looked away. Vidovich said, "You asked about Prince. We may have a problem. The damage is obviously substantial and the wounds will not heal, not now anyway. Looks like he knew exactly what he was doing." Lacey asked, "Can you stop it right there?" Agent Suarez froze the video. Lacey said, "So let's go slow here. He apparently tried to mutilate his fingers to avoid getting printed, which I assume is possible even after death." Agent Neff said, "Yes, it happens all the time, assuming the hands and fingers are in decent shape." "Okay, so assuming he wanted to destroy his prints, and assuming that he had already altered them in some way, wouldn't it be reasonable to assume he knew about the partial thumbprint?" Vidovich smiled and said, "Exactly. Somehow Bannock knew he had a print." They looked at Jerry and she shook her head. "No idea." Allie asked, "Why would he care? If he's planning a suicide anyway, why would he worry about getting caught?" Jerry replied, "Now you're trying to think like Bannock. He had a death wish, which is not unusual for serial killers. They can't stop what they're doing on their own volition, so they want someone else to stop them. The ruined reputation, the disgrace to the memory of his parents, the loss of everything he had worked for." Vidovich said, "Some of the more famous killers had strong death wishes, Bundy, Gacy. It's not at all unusual.
The video ended. Jerry asked, could you please go back to the beginning?
Suarez pressed buttons, and there was Bannock's ghostly face again.
Jerry said, just freeze it right there. I want to see him dead. I've waited a long time.
Vidovich glanced at Lacey and Allie. After a pause, he continued, we could have a messy situation brewing here. Evidently, he left a new will and some specific instructions. Wants to be cremated immediately and his ashes scattered over the mountains out there. How nice. We, of course, want to preserve the body so we can try like hell to get a thumbprint. The problem is that he's not exactly in our custody. You can't arrest a corpse. Our warrant expired the moment he died. I just spoke with legal in Washington and they're scratching their heads.
You can't allow him to be cremated, Lacey said. Get a court order.
Evidently, it's not that simple. Which court? Florida? New Mexico? There's no law requiring a dead person to be transported back home for a burial. This guy planned everything and ordered his executor to cremate him out there with no autopsy.
Jerry stared at the still shot of the corpse, shook her head, and said, even from the grave, he's disrupting our lives.
But it's over, Jerry, Lacey said, touching her on the arm. It'll never be over now. Bannock will never be brought to justice.
He got away with it, Lacey.
No, he's dead, and he won't kill again. Jerry snorted and looked away. Let's get out of here.
Allie dropped them off at Lacey's apartment and went to his. He had been summoned to Orlando for work, but, in a rather testy conversation, had informed his supervisor that he needed a couple of days at home. The women sat in the den and tried to absorb even more drama. What could be next? What could top the news of Bannock's death?
If there was never a match for the partial thumbprint, then there would never be physical evidence linking him to the murders of Verno and Dunwoody. As for the other murders, they had only motive and method. Convicting him with such flimsy evidence would be impossible. And now that he was dead, no police, local, state, or federal would waste time pursuing him. Their cases had been cold for decades anyway. Why get excited now?
Jerry was certain they would welcome the news of Bannock's probable guilt, inform the families, and happily close the files. His comments, denials, deflections, and assertions the previous Saturday in a dark cabin deep in the Alabama countryside were of little help to the police. None of what he said could ever be admitted in court, and he had been careful not to expressly admit any wrongdoing. He was, after all, a trial judge. At times, Jerry was emotional and at times inconsolable. Her life's work had come to an abrupt and unsatisfactory end. Dead as he was, Bannock was walking away practically unscathed. The kidnapping charge, if and when it was ever reported, would only add confusion and prove nothing. The details behind it would never be made known. He had not been arrested for anything. His name would never be linked to his victims. But there were also moments of visible relief. The monster was no longer on her trail. She would no longer inhabit the same world as Ross Bannock, a man she had loathed for so long that he had become a part of her life. She would never miss him. But how would she fill the vacancy? She had read somewhere that we often grow to admire, even love, the very thing we so obsessively hate. It can become a part of our life, and we grow to rely on it. To need it. It defines us. At 2:30, an FBI agent knocked on the door and informed Lacey that her little security detail had been called back to the office. The danger was now gone. The coast was clear. She thanked him and said goodbye. Jerry asked to spend one more night. It might take some time to completely relax, and she wanted to go for a long walk, alone, through the neighborhood, the campus, and downtown. She wanted to taste the freedom of moving about without glancing around, without worrying, without even thinking of him. And when Lacey came home from the office, she, Jerry, wanted to get in the kitchen and cook dinner together. She had stopped cooking years earlier, even decades ago, when her evenings became consumed with her pursuit. Lacey said, "Of course." After she left, Jerry sat on the sofa and kept repeating to herself that Bannock was dead. The world was a better place. 44. Diana Zhang had never given a thought to serving as the executrix of someone's will and estate. In fact, as the secretary to a judge, she knew enough about probate to know it should be avoided when possible. Now that she had been victimized by her former boss and saddled with an unwanted task that gave every indication, at least initially, of being complicated and burdensome, if not impossible, she struggled to find a good attitude toward her new role. The fourth page, the one with the list of assets, kept her in the game. She had never thought about Judge Bannock's death. He was so young, and she had certainly never thought about being included in his estate plans. Not long after the shock of his death began to wear off, she couldn't help but think about her windfall. Frankly, she didn't care if he was cremated or where he was buried, especially with the FBI breathing down her neck. They asked her to hold off on any burial plans, and everything else for that matter. There was no hurry. He was being iced in the county morgue far away, and if the FBI wanted her to take things slow, then she had no qualms with that. They had agreed not to tamper with the body as long as she agreed to allow them to extensively photograph the hands and fingers. She was quoted at length in Wednesday's edition of the Ledger. After some glowing comments about her old boss, she said that he had been ill for some time but was too private to discuss his health. The entire office was shocked and saddened, as were his colleagues and members of the bar. The story covered the entire bottom half of the front page with a fine photo of a younger Bannock. There was no mention of the arrest warrant for kidnapping. By noon Wednesday, the FBI had seized and searched the SUV he left behind in the long-term lot of the Birmingham airport, as well as the Avis rental they tracked to Pecos Mountain Lodge. Not surprisingly, both had been thoroughly wiped and there were no prints. The FedEx envelope sent to Diana was covered with prints, but none matched the parcel found on Verno's phone. The cabin at Gant Lake was combed through and yielded nothing useful. Every square inch of his room at the lodge and every surface he could have possibly touched had been examined twice over without success. A steward said he had seen him several times, always with gloves. A team of the Bureau's top fingerprint experts hurried down and examined the fingers and thumbs. All were cooked and corroded to the point of being thoroughly destroyed. Since the body was to be cremated, Vidovich made the decision to remove the hands and take them to the lab. He mentioned this to Diana Zhang, who was at first horrified. However, as Vidovich leaned on her and made it plain that the hands and fingers, along with the entire body, were about to be ashes anyway, what was the harm? When she still hesitated, he threatened to haul her before a federal magistrate. Diana was already tired of her new job. The longer he was in the morgue, the more problems he was creating. She would never see his body, with or without the hands. It was 1,000 miles away, and that wasn't far enough. She finally said yes to the amputations, and the hands were removed and rushed to the forensics lab in Clarksburg, West Virginia. What was left of Judge Ross Bannock was hauled to a crematorium in Santa Fe, properly reduced to ashes, and stuffed in a plastic urn that the mortician put in storage until further orders. Lacey spoke to Vidovich throughout the day and relayed the developments to Jerry, who was suddenly eager to gather her things and get home. The FBI had searched her car and found no useful prints, but did find the GPS monitor next to the gas tank. They sent it to Clarksburg for examination. Somehow, somewhere in the horror and chaos of the kidnapping, Bannock had taken her pistol and small carry-on bag, but had left behind her phone and laptop. She assumed he did not want to risk being tracked with her devices. He also left behind her purse and keys. He didn't need the small amount of cash, nor her credit cards, and he was driving his own vehicle, though Jerry never saw it. The same two handsome agents who had driven her away from the hospital on Sunday now appeared in Tallahassee with her Camry and belongings. They had been ordered to follow her back to Mobile and arrange for her door locks to be changed. She said, "No, thanks," and they reluctantly left. After an early dinner with Lacey and Allie, Jerry hugged them both, offered her heartfelt thanks, promised to see them again soon, and left for Mobile, 4 hours away. As she left town, she turned the rearview mirror sideways so she wouldn't keep glancing at it. Some habits would be hard to break. Her thoughts were scrambled, and her mood swung radically. She was lucky to be alive, and her sore wrists were a constant reminder of the close call. However, that episode, as terrifying as it was, had a clear end to it. Luck intervened, and she escaped a certain death. She was destined to keep living, but for what purpose? She felt as though her project was incomplete, but where was the finish line? She smiled at the pleasant thought of not living in the same world with Bannock, but then she almost cursed at the reality that he got away with his murders. He would never face his victims, never be hauled into a courtroom, perhaps even his own, in an orange jumpsuit with shackles around his ankles. He would never suffer the immeasurable humiliation of seeing his mugshot on the front page, of being scorned by his friends, removed from the bench, convicted of his heinous crimes, and locked away. He would not make history as the first American judge to be convicted of murder, nor would he be remembered as a legendary serial killer. He would never rot in the prison cell he so deserved. Without further proof of his guilt, the families of his victims would never know of his probable guilt. She knew their names, all of them. The parents and siblings of Eileen Nickelberry, the two children of Ashley Barrasso, now both in their early 20s, the widow and two sons of Perry Kroenke, the family of Mike Dunwoody, the only accidental victim she knew of, the children of Danny Cleveland, the families of Lanny Verno and Mal Schnetzer. And what would she tell her own family? Her older brother Alfred in California and Denise at Michigan? Would she upset their worlds with the hard-to-believe story that she found the killer, but he escaped justice? Why bother? The only time they discussed the murder of Brian Burke was when she, Jerry, brought up the subject. She managed to lighten up by reminding herself that the case was not closed. The FBI was fully involved, and they were due a break. Bannock might yet get implicated in one or more of his murders. If one could be proven, then surely the FBI could inform the local police departments, who could in turn meet with the families. Justice would remain permanently elusive, but perhaps some of the families could find closure if they knew the truth. For Jerry, closure seemed impossible. 45. Late Thursday morning, Lacey and her task force met for the last time and were happily retiring the Bannock matter into the dismissal drawer when Felicity interrupted with an urgent call. Sadell was savoring her oxygen, and Darren was debating what size latte to run and fetch.
"It's Betty Rowe, and she says it's important," Felicity announced through the speaker. Lacey rolled her eyes and sighed with frustration. She had hoped that she might be able to go a few days without hearing Jerry's voice, but wasn't really surprised. Darren bolted for the door on his coffee run. Sadell closed her eyes as if ready for another nap.
"Good morning, Betty," Lacey said. "We can drop the Betty routine, can't we now, Lacey?"
"Sure. And how are you this morning, Jerry?"
"Marvelous. I feel 50 pounds lighter and I can't stop smiling. The fact that he's gone is such a burden off my brain and body. I can't tell you how wonderful it feels."
"That's great to hear, Jerry. It's been a long time."
"It's been a lifetime, Lacey. I've lived with that creep for decades. Anyway, though, I couldn't sleep. I was up all night because I thought of one more little adventure and I need your help. Preferably with Allie in tow."
"Allie left this morning for parts unknown."
"Then bring Darren. I suppose he's the next available white boy."
"I guess.
Bring him where?"
"To Pensacola?"
"I'm listening, but I'm already skeptical."
"Don't be. Trust me. Surely I've earned your trust by now."
"You have."
"Good. Please drop what you're doing and come to Pensacola."
"Okay. I'm struggling, but still listening."
"It's not exactly right around the corner."
I know. 1 hour for me, 3 for you, but it could be crucial. It could put the final nail in his coffin.
So to speak, he didn't want a coffin.
Right.
"Look, Lacey, I've found the truck."
"Which truck?"
"The truck Bannock was driving the day he killed Verno and Dunwoody in Biloxi. The truck that was spotted by the old man sitting on his porch in downtown Neely, Mississippi when Bannock dropped the phones in the mailbox. That truck."
Lacey slowly said, "So?"
"So it hasn't been checked for prints."
"Wait, I believe Darren tracked it down."
"Yes, sort of. It's a 2009 half-ton pickup, light gray in color, purchased by Bannock in 2012. He owned it for 2 years, used it in the Biloxi murders, then traded it in a month later. A man named Traeger bought it from a used car lot, drove it 2 months until he was hit by a drunk driver. State Farm totaled the truck and gave a check to Traeger, who signed over the title. State Farm sold it for scrap. This is all according to what you told me 3 weeks ago."
"Right, I remember now. Darren said it was a dead end."
"Well, not exactly. The truck was not sold for scrap, but for parts. I think I've found it in a salvage yard outside of Milton, just north of Pensacola. Do you have Google Maps?"
"Sure."
"Okay. I'll send you the link for Dusty's salvage outside of Milton. It buys wrecks from insurance companies, sells off the parts. 90 acres of nothing but banged up cars and trucks. I tracked down the adjuster who handled the Traeger claim, and he's pretty sure the truck went to Dusty's."
"Expecting the worst," Lacey asked.
"And what am I supposed to do?"
"Right. The three of us, you, me, Darren, are going to find the truck and have a look. If Bannock owned it for 2 years, then there might be prints. He wouldn't wipe it down because he didn't know about his wayward thumb on Verno's phone. He sold it months before that."
90 acres?
"Come on, Lacey. This might be our big break.
Sure, it's a needle in a haystack, but the needle is there.
How long do prints last?
Years, depending on a bunch of factors. Surface, weather, imprint, etc. Lacey was not surprised that Jerry knew the ins and outs of fingerprints.
Let's just call the FBI.
Gee, I've never heard that before. We'll call them later. Let's find the truck first, then decide what to do.
The impulse was to tell Jerry how swamped she was, how chaotic the office had become in her absence, and so on. But she knew any and all excuses would be blown off, completely ignored.
Jerry had tracked down a serial killer the police had never heard of, and she had done so by being tenacious. Lacey simply wasn't up to an argument.
She frowned at Sidell, who was dozing, and said, "We can't be there until 4.
Dusty closes at 5. Hustle up. Don't wear a dress." Ernie worked one end of the long front counter, and when they entered the parts department, he was the only one of 4 associates who was not on the phone. Without a smile, he waved them over to his turf. The decor was dented hubcaps and old steering wheels, and behind the counter were tall rows of bins filled with used auto parts. One wall was an impressive rack of used car batteries. The place reeked of stale oil, and all 4 associates had at least 2 grease stains on their shirts. Ernie had his share, plus an oil rag hanging from a rear pocket. An unlit cigar was screwed into one side of his mouth.
"Help you?" he growled.
They were obviously out of place. Lacey turned on the megawatt smile and said, "Yes, thank you. We're looking for a 2009 Chevrolet pickup truck."
"Got thousands here. Need to narrow it down, honey."
At another time, the honey would have sent her into orbit, but the moment was not right to set him straight.
"You looking for parts?"
"No, not exactly," she said, still all smiles.
"Look, ma'am, we sell parts, used parts, nothing but parts. We got over 100,000 wrecks out there, more coming in every day."
Lacey realized they were getting nowhere. She slid across a business card and said, "We're investigating allegations of wrongdoing. We work for the state of Florida."
"You a cop?"
he asked, recoiling. Dusty's gave every indication of being the type of place where cash was king, taxes were routinely avoided, and all manner of criminal activity was just below the surface. 2 other associates, both still on the phone, glanced over.
"No,"
Lacey said quickly. Jerry was admiring some hubcaps as Darren checked his phone.
"Not at all. We just need to find this truck."
She slid across a copy of the title Jerry had found online. Ernie took it and gazed at the screen of his bulky 1970s-style computer, it too with oil stains. He finger-pecked and frowned and shook his old keyboard.
He finally mumbled, "Came in back in January, South Lot, row 84.
He looked at Lacey and said,
"Got it? Look, lady, we sell parts here. We don't give free tours, you know?"
A bit louder, she said, "Sure, I can always come back with a warrant." It was apparent, from his startled reaction, that warrants were not welcome around Dusty's. Ernie nodded toward the back and said, "Follow me." He led them through a rear door. To one side was a long metal building with bays filled with cars and trucks in various stages of demolition. To the other side was a grand view of acres and acres of nothing but wrecked vehicles. He waved to his right and said, "Cars over there." He waved to his left and said, "Trucks and vans over there. South Lot is that way, about 1/2 mile. Look for row 84. With some luck, you'll find it. We close at 5, and you don't want to get locked in here at night."
Darren pointed to a kid in a golf cart and asked Ernie, "Can we borrow that?"
"Everything's for sale around here, boss. Ask Herman."
Without another word, Ernie turned and walked away. For $5, Herman would take them to row 84. They piled in the cart and were soon zipping past thousands of wrecked and gutted vehicles, most missing their hoods, all without tires, some with weeds growing through the windows. He stopped in front of a gray truck and they got out. Lacey handed him another $5 bill and said, "Look, Herman, can you come back and get us at closing time?" He grinned, took the money, grunted a response, and wheeled away. The truck had been T-boned at the passenger's door and was well demolished, but the engine was intact and had already been scavenged. As they gawked at it, Lacey asked, "So what do we do now?" "Let's take out some pistons," Darren said, like a real smartass. "Not exactly," Jerry said, "but you're on the right track. Think of things Bannock wouldn't touch, and the engine comes first. Now think of the things he would have touched. Steering wheel, dash, signal switch, gear shift, all the switches and buttons." "And you brought your dusting powder?" Lacey said. "No, but I do know how to find prints. Our backup plan is to get the FBI out here for a proper search. Right now, I just want to look around." "The glove box," Darren said. "Yes, and under the seat, behind the seat. Think about your own car and all the crap that falls through the cracks. Gloves, anyone?" She reached into her purse and removed plastic gloves. They dutifully put them on. "I'm going in," Jerry said. "Darren, you check the back. Lacey, see if you can look behind the seat on the other side." "Watch for snakes," Darren said, and the women almost shrieked. Half the bench seat was crushed and mangled, and the passenger door was hanging by a thread. Lacey stepped through weeds and managed to get it open. Its side pocket was empty. She saw nothing of interest on the passenger side. Jerry gently scraped glass from the driver's seat and sat at the wheel. She reached over and tried to open the glove box, but it was jammed tight. Their first pass produced nothing. Jerry said, "We need to open the glove box. If we're in luck, there's an owner's manual and assorted paperwork, same as in every car, right?" Lacey asked, "What's an owner's manual?" "Typical," mumbled Darren. Lacey was suddenly hit with a memory, and her knees went weak. She gasped and bent over, hands on knees, trying to breathe. "Are you okay?" Jerry asked, touching her shoulder. "No, sorry, just give me a moment." Darren looked at Jerry and said, "It's her car wreck. The one where Hugo was killed not that long ago." Jerry said, "I'm so sorry, Lacey. I just wasn't thinking." She stood and took a deep breath. "We should have brought some water," Jerry said. "I'm sorry." "It's okay. I'm fine now. Let's get out of here and report this to the FBI. They can handle the search." Jerry said, "Okay, but first I want to see what's in that glove box." Parked 5 feet away was a large Ford with a crushed roof. Darren poked around it and found a torn piece of the left door rocker panel. He twisted it free and eased into the seat of the gray Chevy truck. He jammed his new tool into the damaged glove box, but it would not open. He pried, shoved, dug, jammed again and again, but its door would not open. The glove box was partially crushed and locked tight. "I thought you were stronger than that," Lacey observed as she and Jerry watched every move. Darren glared at her, took a deep breath, wiped his forehead, and attacked the glove box again. He finally pried open a narrow gap and managed to snap off the door. He grinned at Lacey and Jerry and tossed his tool into the weeds. He pulled his gloves tight, then slowly removed a plastic bifold, a brochure for tire warranties, a receipt for an oil change charged to a Mr. Robert Traeger, a AAA solicitation of some variety, and two rusted screwdrivers. He handed the bifold to Jerry and got out of the truck. The three of them stared at their loot. "Should we open it?" Lacey asked. Jerry held it with both hands and said, "Odds are Bannock touched this at some time. Odds are he didn't wipe it down, couldn't have, really. At least not in the past month when he was scrubbing everything else." Lacey said, "Let's play it safe and take it to the FBI." "Yes, absolutely. But let's have a peek first." She slowly opened the bifold and removed the owner's manual. Stuffed inside it were extended warranty papers, an old Florida registration card issued to Robert Traeger, and two receipts from an auto parts store. A card fell out and floated to the ground. Lacey picked it up, read it, smiled, and said, "Bingo." It was a State Farm insurance card issued to Waveland Shores, one of Bannock's fronts. It covered the six-month period from January to July of 2013 and listed the policy number, limits of coverage, VIN, and agent's name. On the backside were instructions on what to do in case of an accident. She showed it to Jerry and Darren, who were afraid to touch it, then placed it back in the owner's manual. Jerry said, "I like our odds right now." "I'm calling Clay Vidovich," Lacey said as she pulled out her phone. They hiked for 10 minutes until they saw Herman in his golf cart. He drove them to the front, where they checked in with Ernie, who, of course, wanted $10 for the owner's manual. Lacey bargained him down to $5 to be covered by the taxpayers of Florida, and they left Dusty's. An hour later, they were in downtown Pensacola having a soda in the conference room with Vidovich and agents Neff and Suarez. As they detailed their adventure, two technicians were poring over the manual, insurance card, and other items from the glove box. Vidovich was saying, "Yes, we're heading out in the morning, flight's at 8. We'll get back to Washington in the afternoon. Thanks to you, Jerry, it's been a rather productive trip, wouldn't you say?" "It's a mixed bag," she said without a smile. "We found our man, but he got away, on his own terms." "The killings have stopped, and that's not always the case. We can close this one, but we have others." "How many, if I may be so bold to inquire?" Darren asked. Vidovich looked at Neff, who shrugged as if she couldn't say. "About a dozen, of all varieties." "Anyone like Bannock?" Lacey asked. He smiled and shook his head. "Not that we know of, and we don't pretend to know them all. Most of these guys kill at random and never know their victims. Bannock was certainly different. He had a list, and he stalked them for years. We would have never found him, Jerry, without you." The door opened. A technician walked in and said, "We have two very good thumbprints, both from the insurance card. I just sent them to the lab at Clarksburg." He left, and Vidovich followed him out. Suarez said, "They'll give them priority and ram them through the databanks. We can check millions of prints in a matter of minutes." "Pretty amazing," Darren said.
"It is."
Lacey asked, "So if there's a match, what happens?"
"Not much," Neff said. "We'll know for sure that Bannock killed Verno and Dunwoody, but it will be impossible to pursue the case."
"If he were alive, still a tough one. I wouldn't want to be the prosecutor."
"What about the other murders?" Jerry asked.
Suarez said, "Not much we can do, really. I'm sure we'll meet with the local police and pass along the news. They'll meet with the families, if the families are up to it. Some will want to talk, others will not. What about your family?"
Jerry said, "Oh, I'm sure I'll tell them at some point. The conversation waned as they waited. Darren went to the men's room. Lacey freshened the soft drinks. Vidovich returned with a smile and said, "We have a clear match. Congratulations. It can now be proven that Judge Bannock did indeed kill Lanny Verno and Mike Dunwoody. At this point, folks, that's the best we can hope for." Lacey said, "I need a drink." Vidovich said, "Well, I was thinking about a drink followed by a long celebratory dinner, courtesy of the FBI. Jerry nodded her approval as she wiped tears. 46. 2 weeks later, Lacey and Allie flew to Miami, rented a car, and made a leisurely drive down Highway 1, south through Key Largo to Isla Mirada, where they stopped for a long lunch on a patio at the water's edge. They continued on, passed through Marathon, then stopped when the highway ended in Key West. They checked into the Pier House Resort and got a room on the ocean. They splashed in the water, walked through the sand, lounged on the beach, and had a cocktail watching a beautiful sunset. The following day, a Saturday, they left Key West, drove an hour to Marathon, and found the Kroenke home in Grassy Key, a plush, gated community on the water. Their appointment was for 10 a.m., and they arrived a few minutes early. Jane Kroenke greeted them warmly and led them to the patio where her two sons, Roger and Guff, were waiting. They had driven down from Miami the day before. Minutes later, Chief Turnbull of the Marathon Police arrived. Allie excused himself and took his coffee to the front of the house. After the obligatory round of chit-chat, Lacey said, "This won't take long. As I said on the phone, I'm the interim director of the Board on Judicial Conduct, and it is our duty to investigate complaints of misconduct filed against state court judges. Back in March, we met with a woman whose father was murdered in 1992, and she claimed she had learned the identity of his killer. She filed a formal complaint, and we were required by state law to get involved. She alleged that the suspect, a sitting judge, was responsible for the murders of Mr. Kroenke, as well as two men in Biloxi, Mississippi. We don't normally investigate murders, but we had no choice. A colleague and I came here to Marathon in March and met with the chief, who was most cooperative. We got nowhere, really, because, as you well know, evidence has been hard to come by. We eventually contacted the FBI and welcomed its behavioral analysis unit, the elite team that goes after serial killers." She paused and took a sip of lemonade. They were hanging on every word and seemed thoroughly overwhelmed. She almost felt sorry for them. "The judge in question is Ross Bannock from the Pensacola District. We suspect he was responsible for at least 10 murders over the past 20 years, including Mr. Kroenke. 3 weeks ago, he committed suicide in an addiction treatment facility near Santa Fe. A thumbprint links him to the two killings in Biloxi, but there is still no evidence that he killed Mr. Kroenke. All we have is motive and method." Jane Kroenke wiped her eyes as Guff patted her arm. "What's the motive?" Roger asked. "It goes back to 1989, when Bannock worked in your father's firm as a summer intern. For reasons unknown, he was not offered an associate's position upon graduation. Your father supervised the interns that year and wrote Bannock the letter denying him a job. Evidently, he took it hard." "And he waited 23 years to kill him?" Guff asked. "He did. He was very patient, very calculating. He knew all of his victims, and he stalked them until the right moment.
We'll never know the details because Bannock destroyed everything before he killed himself. Records, notes, hard drives, everything. He knew the FBI was finally closing in. He was extremely thorough, quite brilliant, actually. The FBI is impressed. They absorbed this in disbelief and said nothing. After a long pause, Chief Turnbull said, "You mentioned method." "They were all the same, with one exception. A blow to the head, then strangulation with a rope. The same type of rope every time, secured with a seldom-used tie-off called the double clove hitch. It's sometimes used by sailors." "His calling card?" "Yes, his calling card, which is not unusual. The FBI profilers believe he had no desire to get caught, but wanted someone to know of his work. They also believe he had some type of a death wish, thus the suicide."
"How'd he kill himself?"
Roger asked.
"Drug overdose.
We're not sure of the drug because there was no autopsy at his instructions. One was not really needed. The FBI examined his thumbs and fingers, but they were too damaged to yield any prints."
"My father was killed by a judge?" Guff asked.
"That's what we believe, yes, but it will never be proven."
"And he will never be exposed?"
"The thumbprint was left behind in the Biloxi murders. The sheriff there plans to meet with the victims' families and decide what to do. There is a chance they will release the information that the murders have been solved and that Bannock was the killer."
"I certainly hope so," Roger said.
"But no prosecution?" Guff asked.
"No.
He's dead, and I seriously doubt they will try to convict him in absentia. The sheriff believes the families, at least one of them, will not want to pursue the matter. Any prosecution will be complicated, if not impossible, because Bannock will not be around to confront his accusers."
Jane Kroenke gritted her teeth and said, "I don't know what to say. Are we supposed to be relieved or angry or what?"
Lacey shrugged and said, "I'm afraid I can't answer that." Guff said, "But there will be no report, no news, nothing to let the public know that our father was killed by this guy. Right? I can't control what you might say to a reporter, but without more evidence, I'm not sure anything can be printed. It might be problematic to accuse a dead man with insufficient proof." Another long pause as they struggled to make sense of it. Roger finally asked,
"These other victims, who were they?"
"People from his past, people who had aggrieved him in some way, a law school professor, a lawyer who screwed him out of a fee, a couple of old girlfriends, a former client who filed a complaint, a reporter who exposed a shady land deal, a scoutmaster. We believe that Bannock was sexually abused by his scoutmaster when he was 12 or so. Maybe that's where it all started. We'll never know." Guff shook his head in exasperation, stood, stuffed his hands in his pockets, and walked around the deck. Jane asked, "If he was so brilliant, how did you catch him?"
"We didn't. The police didn't. Chief here can attest to the fact that there was almost no evidence left behind."
"So how?" "Well, it's a long story and an unbelievable one at that. I'll skip the details and cut to the chase. His second victim, or at least the man we think was number two, was Bannock's professor at law school. He has a daughter who became obsessed with her father's murder. Eventually, she became suspicious of Bannock and she stalked him for 20 years. When she became convinced, and when she mustered the courage, she brought the case to us. We didn't want it, but we had no choice. It didn't take long to get the FBI involved." Please tell her we say thanks, Jane said.
I will. She's quite remarkable. We'd like to meet her one day, Roger said.
Maybe, who knows, but she is quite timid.
The chief said, well, she solved the case that we couldn't. Sounds like the FBI should hire her.
They would love to.
Look, I'm sorry to deliver this news, but I thought you would want to know. You have my phone number if you have any questions.
Guff said, oh, I'm sure we'll have 1,000 questions.
Anytime, but I can't promise all the answers. Lacey was ready to go. They thanked her again and again and walked her to the car where Allie was waiting. Late in the afternoon, the resort was hopping with music from the bars, a rowdy volleyball game in the sand, kids splashing in the pool. A reggae band tuned up under some palm trees. Sailboats crisscrossed the crystal blue water in the distance. Lacey had enough of the sun and wanted to go for a walk. At the point, they happened upon a wedding being organized around a small chapel in the sand. Guests were arriving and sipping champagne.
What a lovely chapel, she said.
Not a bad place for a wedding.
It's nice, Allie said.
I have it reserved for September the 27th. Are you busy that day?
Well, I don't know. Why?
You can be so slow at times. That's the day we're getting married, right here. I've already paid the deposit.
He took her hand and pulled her closer.
What about the proposal and all that?
I just proposed. Evidently, you couldn't do it. And I'll take that ring now.
He laughed and kissed her.
Why don't you just go ahead and buy one yourself, since you're taking charge?
I've thought about it, but that's left for you.
And I like oval diamonds.
Okay, I'll get right on it. Anything else I should know?
Yes.
I picked that date because it gives us 4 months to wrap up our careers and begin our new life. I'm quitting. You're quitting. It's either me or the FBI.
Do I have a choice?
No. He laughed, kissed her again, and then laughed some more. I'll stick with you.
Good answer.
And I'm sure the honeymoon is planned.
It is. We're leaving for a month. We'll start on the Amalfi Coast in Italy, bum around there, take trains to Portofino, Nice, southern France, maybe end up in Paris. We'll play it by ear and decide as we go.
I like it. And when we come back?
If we come back, then we'll figure out the next chapter.
A barefoot groomsman in Bermuda shorts, pink shirt, and bow tie walked over with 2 glasses of champagne and said, "Join the party. We need more guests." They took the champagne, found seats in the back row, and felt right at home watching 2 complete strangers exchange vows. Lacey was already taking notes on how she would do things differently.
This is Mary Louise Parker. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Judge's List by John Grisham. This program was directed by Jessica Kay. Introduction directed by John McElroy. Executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Edited by Elgin Productions, Incorporated. Text copyright 2021 by Belfry Holdings, Incorporated. Production copyright 2021, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.